was finally swinging back in his direction, from right to left, and that Barack Obama represented a once-in-a-generation opportunity to restore activist government as the country's dominant public philosophy. As his last act before he died of brain cancer, Ted Kennedy, the liberal lion of the Senate who spent 40 years pushing universal health care, passed the torch to Barack Obama. It is no exaggeration to say that practically every major measure proposed during Obama's 4 years in the White House flowed from that transaction, including Obamacare, the preferential treatment of unions, the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, and the veto of the Keystone XL pipeline, to name just the most familiar. With Obama, America was in the hands of the most left-leaning president in its history. All of which goes a long way toward explaining Barack Obama's mishandling of the economy. Obama likes to remind his critics that he inherited the greatest financial crisis since the Great Depression from George W. Bush. True enough. But what he conveniently fails to mention is that his policies only made matters worse and prolonged America's suffering. Many reasons have been given for this failure, including the fact that Obama picked the wrong economic team. By choosing Timothy Geithner as Treasury Secretary, Lawrence Summers as Director of the National Economic Council, Austin Goolsbee as Chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, and Melody Barnes as his Chief Domestic Policy Advisor, Obama stacked the deck with liberal neo-Keynesians who favored government activism over the private sector. But there was a more basic reason for Obama's failure. He and his economic advisors ignored the lessons of history and were doomed to repeat the mistakes made by Franklin Roosevelt and his New Dealers in the 1930s. As syndicated columnist Amity Schlaes points out in The Forgotten Man, her brilliant account of the Great Depression, liberals have embraced a flawed myth about Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. They believe that the economy of 1930 or 1931 could not revive without extensive intervention by Washington. The same history teaches that the New Deal was the period in which Americans learned that government spending was important to recoveries, and that the consumer alone can solve the problem of excess capacity on the producer's side. Schlaes throws cold water on this liberal interpretation of the Great Depression. The problem with Roosevelt and his New Dealers, she writes, was their naivete about the economic value of Soviet-style or European-style collectivism, and the fact that they forced such collectivism upon their own country. The New Yorker magazine's cartoons of the plump, terrified Wall Streeter were accurate. Business was terrified of the president. But the cartoons did not depict the consequences of that intimidation, that business decided to wait Roosevelt out, hold on to their cash, and invest in future years. Roosevelt retaliated by introducing a tax, the undistributed profits tax, to press the money out of them. Such forays prevented recovery and took the country into the depression within the depression of 1937 and 1938. Tax increases, intimidation of businessmen, massive new burdens on the economy. All of that happened 80 years ago. But there are eerie similarities between the New Deal, which failed to dig America out of the Great Depression, and the Obama administration's self-defeating efforts to stimulate the economy and end the Great Recession. Indeed, Obama's $800 billion neo-Keynesian stimulus package actually impeded economic recovery. According to John B. Taylor, a Stanford University economist who carried out an in-depth study of the stimulus, the government spending did not result in growth and jobs. Individuals and families largely saved the transfers and tax rebates, Taylor wrote. The federal government increased purchases, but by only an immaterial amount. State and local governments used the stimulus grants to reduce their net borrowing, rather than to increase expenditures, and they shifted expenditures away from purchases toward transfers. Some argue that the economy would have been worse off without these stimulus packages, but the results do not support that view. when the economy did not respond to Obama's neo-Keynesian stimulus, and the recovery summer of 2010 failed to make an appearance, a desperate president looked around for someone to blame. He focused first on Republicans, whom he referred to as obstructionists and enemies. David Plouffe, who served as Obama's 2008 campaign manager before he became his in-house political strategist, claimed that the president was fighting for the middle class, while the Republicans were bent on preserving tax breaks for millionaires, hedge fund operators, and corporations. The American people will have a choice in 2012 about the direction they want to take the economy, Plouffe said. Do they want basically a Gordon Gekko economy? Or do they want a president who says, every decision I make is focused on the middle class? When such populist poppycock didn't work, Obama looked elsewhere to cast blame. The economy wasn't responding because of the Japanese tsunami, or the Greek budget crisis, or the oil shock caused by the Arab Spring, or anything but his administration's own misguided policies. Obama's own views about what he has and has not learned during his 4 years in the White House say a lot about why he has been such a failure as president. The area in my presidency where I think my management and understanding of the presidency evolved most, Obama has said, and where I think we made the most mistakes, was less on the policy front and more on the communications front. The communications front. How could that be? Didn't liberals hail Obama as the greatest communicator since Ronald Reagan? And didn't Obama have an exalted opinion of his own oratorical skills? For instance, when Robert Marion Barry, a former Democratic congressman from Arkansas, warned Obama in 2010 that his left-wing policies could cause the Democrats to lose seats in the midterm election, just as such policies had under Clinton in 1994, a cocksure Obama replied, "Well, the big difference here and in 94 was you've got me." Was it possible, then, that Obama was now falling back on the lame excuse, "What we have here is a failure to communicate"? That was exactly what he was doing, and so were his cheerleaders on the left. Take Frank Rich, the former columnist of the New York Times. While perhaps no politician can ever duplicate Reagan's brand of sunny and homespun, if Hollywood-honed geniality, Rich wrote, Obama has his own radiance when he wants to turn it on. But Obama is less adept at keeping his messages simple, consistent, and crystal clear. The pitch-perfect showmanship, timing, and salesmanship were in Reagan's resume and bones. Obama doesn't have that training. But he was a great communicator when it came to selling his own story in the campaign, heaven knows. He has rarely rekindled that touch in the White House. It was true that Obama, who had campaigned so effectively against Hillary Clinton and John McCain in 2008, had fumbled badly once he was in the White House. But the reason he lost his personal connection with the American people had little to do with his communication skills. It was not how he communicated, but what he communicated, that lost him the affection of the country. The American people didn't care a fig about the style of Obama's message. They didn't like the substance of his message. He was just too liberal for America. I once asked Ronald Reagan, after he had left the White House, whether he resented the people who charged that much of his public success was due to his skills as the great communicator, rather than to the appeal of his political programs. I think there were other reasons for my effectiveness, Reagan told me. I believe very deeply in the things I advocated in office. When I came into the White House, the previous administration was telling the people about how they were suffering from a malaise. I had the feeling that the American people were hungering for spiritual revival. What's more, unlike Obama, Reagan enjoyed being president, and his joy was contagious. In fact, Reagan told me that he would have considered running for re-election in 1988, when he was nearly 78 years old, if it hadn't been for the 22nd Amendment to the Constitution, limiting presidents to 2 terms in office. It was my own party, the Republican Party, that passed that amendment out of revenge for Roosevelt's 4 terms, he said. But what that amendment is an infringement on the democratic right of the people. The people have a right to vote for whomever they want and for as many times as they want. The people also have a right to vote against a president who has failed them. The question is, will they vote against Barack Obama in 2012? Chapter 22. The Low Road. I'm troubled by rhetoric that pits people against each other. We have never been a nation of haves and have-nots. We are a nation of haves and soon-to-haves, of people who have made it and people who will make it. And that's who we need to remain. United States Senator Marco Rubio. To hear the candidates who run for president tell it, you'd think every election was an historic watershed. This is the most important election in which you will ever have a chance to cast your vote, they tell us every 4 years. This election will decide the course of politics for decades. But most presidential elections are not watershed events. In point of fact, there have been only 6 such political realignments in American history, marking the end of one period and the beginning of another. The election of 1800, in which Vice President Thomas Jefferson defeated President John Adams, who represented Northern Federalist interests, and ushered in a generation of Southern, agrarian-dominated Democratic-Republican party rule. The election of 1828, in which Andrew Jackson, the first president not born of privilege, defeated John Quincy Adams and solidified Democratic Party control. The election of 1860, which brought Abraham Lincoln and the Republicans to the White House and unleashed the forces of the Civil War. The election of 1896, in which Republican William McKinley defeated the populist Democrat William Jennings Bryan and set the United States on a course to become a world industrial power. The election of 1932, in which Franklin Delano Roosevelt created the coalition that made the Democratic Party the dominant political force for almost 50 years. The election of 1980, in which Ronald Reagan attracted working-class Democrats to his cause and launched a generation of conservatism. Will the election of 2012 usher in America's 7th political realignment? A convincing argument can be made that it will. For the election will not only be a referendum on Barack Obama, the most liberal president this country has ever had, but it will also be a plebiscite on the future direction of America. If Obama is defeated, everything the left stands for, universal health care, mandatory union membership, wealth distribution, a bigger and bigger federal government, will be defeated along with him. But if Obama wins, the left will be entrenched for years to come, and the United States will continue its headlong rush toward a bloated, deficit-ridden entitlement state, similar to those in Europe. The election will present voters with a stark choice between a left-wing president who believes in engineering the equality of outcome and a conservative candidate who believes in the equality of opportunity. A vote for Obama will be a vote in favor of an ever larger role for the federal government to ensure so-called fairness in the system. A vote for the Republican candidate will be a vote for less government and greater individual freedom. Every indicator suggests that America is balanced between these two philosophies, and that the country could go either way. There is a genuinely interesting and important debate of ideas to be had over the size, reach, and role of the federal government in our lives, writes Peter Wehner. Honorable people have very different views on this matter. Some, like Obama, are drawn to a European-like model of social democracy, one that wants to centralize more and more power, with the federal government as a means to eliminate income inequality and ensure greater fairness. Others believe the federal government has dramatically exceeded its constitutional authority, that it is leading us down a path to fiscal ruin, and in the process, it is undermining civic character. Obama does not want to engage in such a debate, because he knows he will lose it. Over the past 4 years, the American people have become more conservative. According to a Gallup poll, Democrats have lost their solid political party affiliation advantage in 18 states since 2008, while Republicans have gained a solid advantage in 6 states. The findings make it clear that U.S. states have undergone a dramatic political transformation since 2008, the year President Obama was elected, moving from a democratically dominant political environment to one of parity. Clearly, President Obama faces a much less favorable environment as he seeks a second term in office than he did when he was elected president. And there is more bad news for Obama from the Gallup organization. According to a February 24, 2012 poll, a majority of Americans, 51%, say that Obama's political views are too liberal. Americans' perception of Obama's ideology, says Gallup, has changed significantly since he was elected. 4 years ago, when Gallup first asked this question about Obama while he was competing for the 2008 Democratic presidential nomination, a plurality, 47%, thought his views were about right. At that time, 37% said his views were too liberal, compared with today's 51%. Faced with these poll numbers, David Axelrod, Obama's political Merlin, has waved his magic wand again and conjured up a new persona for his candidate in 2012. Gone, poof, is the American Messiah of 2008, who promised hope and change. Gone, poof, is the self-righteous figure who once proclaimed, "If you don't have any fresh ideas, then you use stale tactics to scare voters. If you don't have a record to run on, then you paint your opponent as someone people should run from." Gone, poof, is Mr. Nice Guy. Axelrod has ripped a page out of Harry Truman's 1948 playbook and fashioned a campaign for Obama in which he demonizes his opponents and runs against a do-nothing Republican Congress and its wealthy supporters. You can hear an echo of "Give 'em hell, Harry," when Obama declares, "This Congress, they are accustomed to doing nothing, and they're comfortable with doing nothing, and they keep on doing nothing." Or when he says, "My attitude is get it done, but if they don't get it done, then we'll be running against a Congress that's not doing anything for the American people, and the choice will be very stark and will be very clear." Axelrod's strategy is virtually a copy of a 65-year-old memorandum written by Harry Truman's political guru, Clark Clifford, entitled "The Politics of 1948. The gist of Clifford's memo was the need to divert attention from Truman's domestic and foreign problems and make the contest a conflict between Congress and the president. In such a battle, Clifford argued, the presidency is vastly more flexible than Congress. There is little possibility that the president will get much cooperation from the Congress, but we want the president to be in a position to receive the credit for whatever they do accomplish, while also being in a position to criticize the Congress for being obstructionists. It is obvious that Team Obama is deliberately following the Clark Clifford strategy, E. Michael Young wrote in American Thinker. Like Truman, Obama called a special session of Congress to propose his American Jobs Act, knowing in advance that the Republican-controlled House would reject it. Like Truman, Obama used an executive order to effect social change in the military by allowing gays to openly serve, to prop up his liberal base. And like Truman, Obama is giving speeches all around the country saying the obstructionist do-nothing Republicans in Congress are blocking his jobs bill, hurting the economy, and currying favor with the wealthy elites. Axelrod's update of the Clifford strategy is aimed at solidifying the Democratic Party base, reclaiming the middle, and dividing the country through class warfare against millionaires, fat cats, and the owners of yachts and corporate jets. There are, however, several problems with this approach. To begin with, despite the conventional wisdom, Truman's campaign against the Republicans in Congress was not the main factor in his come-from-behind victory against Republican Thomas Dewey in 1948. The economy had a lot more to do with it. The unemployment rate in 1947 and 1948 was a more than acceptable 3.5%, and the American economy was growing at a sizzling 6.8% in the first half of 1948. Compare that with Obama's situation today, when unemployment is above 8% and the economy is growing at an anemic 2-3%. Second, in 1948, the Democratic Party was still the dominant force in American politics. Franklin Roosevelt was dead only 3 years, and many Americans still had fond memories of him and his New Deal. The Republicans, by contrast, were burdened by the albatross of Hooverism, a reputation for being indifferent to the plight of the poor and the struggling middle class. About 40% of the country identified with the Democrats back then. Today, only 33% identify as Democrats, and that number is declining all the time. Third, if Obama were a Republican, he could win with this sort of strategy. Repeat your party's most orthodox positions and then rip your opponent to shreds, writes columnist David Brooks. Republicans can win a contest between an orthodox Republican and an orthodox Democrat because they have the mistrust in government issue on their side. Democrats do not have that luxury. The party of big government cannot win an orthodox versus orthodox campaign when only 15% of Americans trust government. It's suicide. Fourth, a strategy of class warfare threatens to damage the coalition that Obama put together in 2008. The president won the lion's share of everyone making under $35,000, notes Mark Penn, a Democratic pollster. He then did very poorly with middle-class voters, but he got a remarkable half of the 26% of voters whose households make over $100,000. Never before have so many voters fallen into that category, and never before had so many of them voted Democratic. Even a majority of the so-called top 1%, making over $200,000, voted for Obama. Without similar support for those upper-income voters, Obama has no way to recreate the numbers that sailed him to victory. What was so brilliant about the Obama 2008 election was that it brought together the upper and lower classes in a common mission of hope and change. Today, he is smashing apart that coalition. When voters are asked in 2012, "Are you better off today than you were 4 years ago?" they can give only one possible answer: no. Therefore, the only way Obama can win a second term in the White House is by diverting attention from his incompetence and sliming his Republican opponent. Over $15 trillion in debt, writes Joe Hagan in New York Magazine. More than 8% unemployment, yawning structural problems, a severely gridlocked government. Obama is in a box, and there is only one way out of this box, the low road. Obama knows this, and he is gearing up for a campaign that will in no way resemble his inspirational Hope and Change campaign in 2008. This time around, his goal is to raise an overwhelming $1 billion campaign chest, unleash super PACs backed by the unlimited financial resources of such left-wing billionaires as George Soros, and get down in the mud and wage the ugliest campaign in modern American history. "It's a deeply pessimistic time," says Steve Schmidt, who served as senior strategist to the presidential campaign of Senator John McCain in 2008. "Neither party is talking honestly or directly about the country's problems and challenges. It's going to be an extremely mean-spirited campaign, filled with non-stop attack ads. The whole focus will be on disqualifying the alternative, not on the country's future. It will be very much the opposite of the Hope and Change theme of 4 years ago." Obama's strategy will be to convince voters that he isn't the issue, that his Republican opponent is the issue, and that, as France's Louis XV famously said, "After me, the flood." The idea will be to frighten voters away from the scary Republican alternative. "This is a choice about who we are and what we stand for," Obama declared, "and whoever wins this next election is going to set the template for this country for a long time to come. The alternative, I think, is an approach to government that would fundamentally cripple America in meeting the challenges of the 21st century." Cripple America. Strong words that suggest a Republican president would devastate, ruin, and destroy the United States. One can just imagine David Axelrod sitting in his war room in Chicago and screening the infamous 1964 anti-Barry Goldwater TV commercial, which was created for President Lyndon Johnson by Tony Schwartz of Doyle Dane Birnbach, and which showed a little girl picking petals from a daisy while an ominous-sounding male voice counted down to the launch of a nuclear missile. As the camera slowly zoomed in, her eye was filled with an atomic mushroom cloud. The implication was that Goldwater would start a nuclear war and cripple America, destroy it. A voiceover from Johnson stated, "These are the stakes, to make a world in which all of God's children can live, or to go into the dark. We must love each other, or we must die." Then another voiceover, this one from sportscaster Chris Schenkel, said, "Vote for President Johnson on November 3rd. The stakes are too high for you to stay home." It's a pretty safe bet that David Axelrod will try to devise an updated version of the Daisy Girl commercial in 2012, and that Barack Obama's mantra will be, "The stakes are too high for you to vote for that frightening Republican." Obama is determined to make the election a contest between two policy alternatives, deliberately omitting the issue of competence, says Dick Morris. He's like an incompetent employee hoping to save his job by advocating a broad-based shift in his corporation's philosophy in the hopes that his bosses will ignore his own poor performance. To win re-election in 2012, Barack Obama must divert the country's attention from his record of incompetence and amateurism. He doesn't want to remind people that America lost its AAA credit rating on his watch, a downgrade that Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina called a firing offense. Republicans will have to remind them. Obama doesn't want to remind people that he increased the national debt by nearly $5 trillion, the most rapid increase in debt under any president. Republicans will have to remind them. Obama doesn't want to remind people that he pushed through a bill that includes more than $1 trillion in new health care spending and contains a 4.5% tax increase. Republicans will have to remind them. Obama doesn't want to remind people that John Corzine's bankrupt financial company, MF Global, which is under investigation by a grand jury for misusing clients' money, was one of the top sources of contributions to Obama's re-election campaign. Republicans will have to remind them. Obama doesn't want to remind people of his erratic stand on illegal immigration, which has swung wildly between fast-paced deportations, removing nearly 400,000 illegal foreigners in each of the last 3 years, to a policy of virtual amnesty. Republicans will have to remind them. Obama doesn't want to remind people of his inconsistency on environmental regulation, first pushing through burdensome anti-business rules to toughen air quality standards, then suddenly scrapping those rules to win over campaign supporters in the business community. Republicans will have to remind them. Obama doesn't want to remind people that he was for lower taxes before he was for higher taxes, that he was for forcing Catholic-affiliated institutions to provide contraceptive and abortion insurance before he was against forcing them to go against their religious principles, that he was for removing terrorists from Guantanamo before he was against it, that he was for bringing the country together before he was for dividing it, that he was for a grand bargain with the Republicans over the debt ceiling before he was against it, that he was for energy independence before he rejected the Keystone Pipeline, that he was in favor of extending an olive branch to the mullahs in Iran before he was against it. Republicans will have to remind America that Barack Obama is the amateur. This concludes the reading of The Amateur, Barack Obama in the White House, by Edward Klein. Copyright 2012 by Edward Klein. This book was read by John McLean. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Regnery Publishing Incorporated and was produced in 2012 by Blackstone Audio Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.blackstoneaudio.com. Thank you.